When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Motorsport Commentary Behind the Scenes for the May 2017 edition of Motorsport. It's on sale now and you can find it at stockists near you as well as on our website at www.motorsportmagazine.com. You can also read, listen to, watch the digital edition and details about that can also be found on the website. If you want to avoid the stress of actually buying single copies, I can highly recommend subscribing. You get the magazine earlier than anyone else, and it's delivered direct to your door. Job done. So, joining me today is Simon Aaron, we've got Nick Trott, we've got Joe Dunn, and Damon Cogman. It is a full house of Motorsport editorial team, so welcome everyone, and thanks for joining me.
Hello.
Now, before we get anywhere, you can, as I mentioned, you can buy this issue on our website, and that is, the direct link for that is shop.motorsportmagazine.com, and it'll be right at the top of the screen for you, and you can get it there nice and easily. So, May 2017 issue, and we have the Ford Cosworth RS500 on the cover. And we're arguing that it's the greatest racing car that ever existed. Now, I don't want to be the fly in the ointment here, but let's talk about the Porsche 917, 956, 962, 935, the Ford GT40, the Auto Unions, the McLaren MP44 or the M23, the Lotus 49 or 72, the Maserati 250F or the Ferrari 156 or 250 GTO short wheelbase, or maybe the Alfa Romeo TPB, or maybe even the Matra 670. Nick, please explain what's going on.
Yeah, well, no problem at all. I'll just hand it over to Joe.
Well, we spelled really out. Back to Nick then.
No, I think the RS500 and Group A touring cars seem to be having their moment right now. I think their appearance at the Goodwood members meeting created a huge amount of publicity and attention, which of course we were keeping an eye on. And it just seems to be there's a generation that are particularly excited about this relatively humble, car that had very humble beginnings. And it seems like whenever you mention RS500 to people at the moment, there's a lot of fond memories of Rouse and Soper and the epic battles. And we, as you know, we had an editorial meeting and we discussed the car and what we could do with it and what kind of package we could pull together. And I went off and spoke to a gentleman who runs the RS500 club in the UK, and he left me with this idea, this concept that you could argue that it is the greatest racing car of all time if you look at a win ratio. So of course I brought this back to the office, and being the newbie, everyone looked at me with blank stares and said, "Go and look at Jim Clark again, will you?" And not these
Lotus 25 boy.
Exactly. So once they'd untied me, I tried to make the point again that this is a really important car at the moment, I think. And So I looked around and tried to find out if we could drive a car. And Ford mentioned they were bringing Eggenberger car over from Germany to Goodwood, and then we tried to work out how to get someone in the car. And but basically, it all started to come together rather nicely. And then Joe worked on the most difficult part of the story, which was to try and look into this myth legend of it perhaps being the greatest racing car of all time. If you look at a few criteria.
So,
Joe, you
passed that on to the intern, didn't you?
That was nice of you.
I did. I've got to say, the statistics back up the assertion that this was the most successful racing car.
In your face, Foster.
There are some criteria. You have to buy the magazine to discover what those criteria are. But once you put them all together, you find the win ratio of the RS500 is not just slightly more than anything else, it is by a long way the most successful car in terms of wins compared to races taking part in.
Right. So, Damon, talk us through the actual cover shot, because surely there were thousands of photos to choose from.
Surprisingly, not that many. This is, even though it wasn't that far in the past,
The 1980s are always a really difficult time to find decent pictures of because of the way that the film has degraded over the years. There's actually not that much around, surprisingly. And Simon will back me up on this because of having used film for the.
Yes. Okay, can I just point out at this stage, not that long ago, is in fact 30 years.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like
it seems like yesterday.
And it's even on the cover, Damon. It's 30th anniversary.
That's the
words
part.
Yeah.
Ah,
got
you. Damon, for those that don't know, is our art editor. He does shapes and colours, not so many words.
Yeah, good at the shapes and colours, not so good at the words. The pictures are amazing, especially as the Eggenberger one is pretty striking with the black and the Dalo. I mean, it's fantastic, isn't it? I can't ask for a better combination. I'm sure the British Racing green and yellow as well would go down pretty well, but a Texaco for another generation, the Texaco star and the Dayglo graphics get people excited of a certain age, so me included.
And I have to say that I think touring cars of that era, which generally just had one or two sponsors on them in big bold messages on the side, on the flanks, on the bonnet, you look at a modern touring car and there are 400 different sponsors, all with postage stamp style stickers on it. Mm. It's just, there's something much purer to my eye about the design and the look of the cars of that period, where they were far less cluttered.
Yeah, you get the feeling it was designed and kind of really thought about, as opposed to what we have now.
Where we can just squeeze one more little sponsor on here, please. Yeah.
I think the sort of the period picture, actually, you're talking about the quality of the picture, but that, to my eyes, makes the cover even better because it's sort of... It dates the car properly. You immediately see that sort of the way the image is, and you can see that it's 30 years old, and the way that sort of sepia colour pictures from 60 years ago date a particular picture. So I think it's good that we've used a period shot.
Yeah, we had options. I mean, we looked to shoot the car ourselves at Goodwood, and there are within the feature there are a number of shots of the car at Goodwood, and they're great images, but. That this car has a kind of an aura, there's something in the ether about this car that's fascinating, and actually that cover shot represents it far better than any of the shots of the car today at Goodwood. And it's just the fact you know Soper's, he's got his open face helmet on there, and he's got his head
cranked,
his hands on the wheel, and his head sort of cocked into the corner, and and you can just see one of the other teammate cars, I think, on the right hand side of the cover. It really, it's just something about that image, isn't there, teleports you back to that time.
And it was also interesting. I mean, Dickie Meaden had the main conversation with Andy Rouse and Steve Soper, but I spoke to both of them as well. And the passion that they both still have they both said it was, the highlight of their touring car careers. And let's face it, they both had very long and very durable and very successful touring car careers. But they both cited the RS500 time just as, the absolute apotheosis of that.
Hmm. Now, this issue is, of course, the one in which we pay tribute to the late John Surtees. It's always a very difficult task, paying tribute to someone like him, a rider, team owner, driver, founder of the Henry Surtees Foundation. He did so much for motorsport and beyond. Nick, how do you begin to do something like this? Because, in situations like this, I'm always reminded of Jenks's sort of, I think, cop-out on Jim Clark's death, where he said, mere words are inadequate to express our feelings, and that was it. But, it's someone of a similar stature, so, how do you approach it?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, of course, is that when the news, hit us in the office, I think, to a man, we were all broken-hearted. He's a towering figure in our world, and huge amount of admiration. I think a number of people felt he didn't receive the accolades he deserved during his lifespan. Yeah. So first thing was this kind of, it was just the moment of shock. And in terms of the production of the magazine and the content we produced, we were halfway through a schedule and there was an opportunity to respond in the best way that we could with the time available. But of course, the first thing we wanted to look at was on the digital side, because it was important that we could deliver some content on the website, which is your bag, Ed, and I think you did a really good job delivering that content. And then on the print side, it was Joe's suggestion. I mean, Doug Nye knew John very well, and he was by far and away the best person to write that piece. And Joe worked with him and assembled some fantastic comments from some other people who had an association with John or the Henry Surtees Foundation, with Simon's assistance as well. And Simon made some great comments and proposed some great ideas about people we could talk to who were perhaps on the periphery of John's motorsport world, but were affected very positively by him and by the Henry Surtees Foundation. So, in short, we got together and did the best we could, and hopefully that the readers will like what we've put together.
Yeah, and we also dug into our own archive, which is obviously available online, and had a trawl through what we've said about John Surtees in the past and what he has said to us in the past. And it was quite fascinating going back, and you realise most of the quotes we found, the direct quotes from John, are from the mid-90s and onwards. You go back to the race reports and features, well, race reports from the 60s and 70s, hardly any driver quotes, if any, at all. They just weren't...
Jenks never used them, did he?
No, Jenks, I mean, he did very technical, very interesting, but didn't quote the drivers ever, as far as... I mean, I'm sure there must be one or two somewhere, but couldn't find a single driver quote from that period. But we had plenty of stuff of John talking in later years about his own career, and some fantastically revealing stuff, you know. Everyone knows a lot of the stories, and I think they're all pretty well summarised within the magazine. But a sad task, but also rewarding, because it is a very acute reminder of what a great sporting figure he is, present tense, and also the ridiculousness of the UK's honours system, that a bloke with 8 world championship titles, 7 on bikes, 1 in a car, isn't a knight.
Yeah. Well, I second that thought. Rest in peace, John. I'm going to move on and look at Mark Hughes's content this month. And I'm wondering whether I'm sort of missing a week in my life, because the Australian Grand Prix was only last weekend. And yet here we are with a paper magazine in front of us, a monthly magazine, no less, with lots of coverage of the Australian Grand Prix. Nick, do you want to take us up on this? So am I missing a week in my life, or what happened?
Well, the magic of modern publishing. Yeah, well, I mean, we looked closely at the schedules, didn't we, Damon?
Yeah.
And Joe, and we realised that our print schedule didn't align with the first race. And so we looked at it, and we thought the first race is super important. So can we move the print schedule in order to include the first race? So we did. And it's not... I've made it sound very easy, but it's actually really hard when you're trying to move a print slot, and there's always a cost imperative. And but either way, we thought it was worthwhile, so we pushed our print deadline so that we can include the copy from Mark. And Mark, you know, absolutely did an amazing job, because he effectively wrote through the night to deliver.
Did we work out how many words he actually wrote in after the Grand Prix? Because he did a 4,500 words Grand Prix report for the website, plus all the magazine stuff. So he must have been...
It was touching 8,000, I think.
Yeah, 8,000 words in an evening.
Yeah, and of course none of the words were wasted either. This was Mark, so it was all beautifully done. But, I mean, Damon deserves some real credit here, because he looked closely at the...
Really?
it's true, yeah.
Breaking news. First time for something.
Cheers, guys.
It's National Bullying Week. Honestly, Damon does, because he I'm still a relative, you know, I'm a rookie here on motorsport, and I'm not as up to speed necessarily on how we send our sections to the printers and the relationships, who you phone up, you know. There's just loads of mechanical stuff that people don't see behind the scenes that you have to kind of do. And Damon, you know, being a trooper, he got onto it and made it all happen. And then, of course, when the copy landed, he had to break out his crayons and design.
That was a busy day.
It was a busy day.
We all arrived on bleary-eyed after sort of staying up till silly o'clock, or getting up at silly o'clock to watch the race, and then kind of the next day thinking, oh, I wish I'd gone to bed earlier. So it was a busy Monday, but definitely worth it for what we've got. So yeah,
and it just bears mentioning what a pro Mark Hughes is. I mean, obviously you take it for granted when you read it on the page, but you know, he turned that copy around, he filed it exactly when he said he would. He stuck rigidly to the brief. He included all the different elements that we'd spoken about and emailed about. And it was just absolutely spot on and arrived. It was in our inbox waiting for us on Monday morning.
Can I just point out that I got up at 3 o'clock to watch the race on Sunday. I then went to Wimbledon Stadium for the last ever meeting in the evening. And then I then got up at 4:30 on Monday morning to subs Mark Coppy so that it was ready and Damon would be a bit less angry when he arrived in the office at 9:15.
Well, great job. I was out of the office at a meeting on that Monday morning. So, okay, I'll revise it. Great job from Joe, Simon and Damon. Yeah. And good job from me for being away from the office while all of this was happening.
Absolutely nailed that. Right, well, before we go on and talk about some of the other columnists this month, I just wanted to mention that the Hall of Fame tickets are now available. So you can come and join us for a star-studded evening, and you can buy the tickets on the website. Also, if you haven't voted for your racing hero yet, there is only 1 week left. So if you want to say and who actually gets inducted, then you can vote now on motorsportmagazine.com/Hall of Fame. And if you want to be kept up to date with all the celebrity guests that are being announced soon, then you can sign up to the newsletter there and you won't miss anything at all. But do go on and vote because you do genuinely actually get a say in who's inducted. Right, moving on to Dickie Meaden. Dickie this month is he's looking back slightly with rose-tinted glasses on sort of racing of the past and things, but he goes on to talk about how exciting the WRC is. You obviously went to the opening round, and I think the new cars are dramatic. They are exciting, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. There's this really interesting concept that's going around at the moment about the increased performance of racing and rally cars and whether you can actually witness it or not. And, of course, on TV, I think having watched the Australian Grand Prix, there were maybe a couple of corners where you went, well, they look pretty quick through there, and the onboards certainly looked slightly more aggressive. But you can only really see it when you're actually there. So I think we all want to be closer to the cars, don't we? And in rallying, you get that. And we had a conversation in the office the other day about the 30 metres that you are away from the racetrack in Formula One and how we all want to get closer. And Dickie's just covered the subject beautifully, really. And he's looking at it from a historic perspective as well because of his historic racing. So, it's interesting. This idea that speed isn't necessarily commensurate with entertainment, So... But Simon's probably got more experience than me. I mean, I'm sure the most spectacular cars you've ever seen on a race circuit have not necessarily been the fastest.
No, absolutely. I mean, in terms of sheer violence and spectacle, drag race, the top field drag racers, which are very fast, obviously. I mean, there's very little to match them in terms of kind of sensory overload. But if you want pure racing, something, and I've written about it in past columns, but something with more power than it's all obvious stuff, more power than grip and no aero. I mean, you look at legends. A few of us went to the truck race meeting at Brands Hatch last weekend. Damon was there on the Sunday.
I was there on Saturday. After the Grand Prix.
No wonder you're all knackered come Monday. I mean, you've already got yourselves to blame, haven't you?
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, it was good. Cool. Anyway, but I mean, the little legends races, I mean, they hunt in packs of 10 or 12 all the time. Yeah. There's loads of overtaking. Historic Formula Ford is the same. Yeah. I mean, it was fantastically exciting when the cars were new in 1971. It's fantastically exciting now. You get... frequently get top three or four cars covered by less than half a second, and it's good, clean, hard racing. No, none of them want to hurt themselves. None of them want to damage the cars because they can't afford it because they're amateur racers. So, they respect each other, and it's absolutely fantastic to watch. And at places like Brands Hatch, Indy Circuit, the punters can get close still. And it all adds to it. They're not the loudest things in the world, but as a form of entertainment, it's second to nowt.
Now, I am worried that we do have a time limit on this, and we haven't even sort of got to the features yet, bar the RS one. So I'm just going to sort of mention some of the rest of the columns. Obviously, you've got Richard Williams, and he is talking about the shift of power in 1957 in the Formula One season, sort of from the Italian teams at the start to the British outfit, Van Wall and Stirling Moss, which is an appropriate piece in light of Ferrari toppling Mercedes in Australia. I've just seen Nick raise an eyebrow. Did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, Richard's going to be writing for us, writing a column for the rest of the year, which is good news. We had a discussion this week, and the columns are great. He worked with Joe before I started, and Joe commissioned his first column, and I'm really pleased to say that he's going to be working with us throughout this year. So,
Good news.
We're all pleased, and I quite like the fact that this particular column just sort of talks about the make do and mend kind of British mentality, which allowed it to the shed tinkerers who actually then came to dominate the sport at the end of the 1950s. And I thought it was quite apt that it happened in the same month as Brexit. there might be some hope for us yet.
We then go on to Matt Oxley, and he's written a great piece about Wayne Gardner. I'm just going to read a small quote out here from the man himself, just because it's such a wonderful insight into sort of racing in those days, but particularly motorcycle racing. After the race, I'd be dying for a beer. I'm a typical Australian. I'd worked up a thirst, so I'd have a beer. Later on, there'd be a barbecue, or we'd end up trashing in my motorhome or someone else's. which is you don't get that in MotoGP nowadays. But typically excellent stuff from Matt. We've obviously talked about the RS feature at the front, so I'm fast-forwarding to page 90 here, and a feature that Dickie has done on the Aston Martin GTE car. This particular chassis is called the Dane Train, so-called because it's filled with Danish drivers. But it's had a remarkable history, this car, Simon, hasn't it?
It has. It's won a whole string of championships over the last 2 or 3 years. And I just think modern GT cars, people say modern motor racing is dull. We're talking before about spectacle. Watching a pack of GT cars, I mean, most GT races nowadays seem to have at least 35 or 40 cars in them. Wonderful to behold, lovely thing to look at. And that's just a very successful example of the breed.
Yeah. And Dickie's actually got behind the wheel of this and driven it.
Yeah, I think we're going to be seeing over the next few months or so, we're going to see Dickie and a few others driving some of these really important racing cars. And Dickie's more than qualified to be able to assess the performance of a car like this, because he can always get within, well, often a few tenths of the factory drivers. He really is a fantastic driver, and his writing is also exceptional. So I was in an event last year. It'd be terribly embarrassed me raising this, but I was in an event last year where we had an Aston Martin Vulcan, and a works driver took it out around the track and set a benchmark lap time, and then Dickie, who'd never seen the car, sat in one before, jumped in and was within 6/10 of the factory driver in a Vulcan. So
it's quite impressive.
Yeah, and then of course he jumps out of the car and he's able to express, you know, very eloquently how the car behaves, and he's done a great job here. And Simon's right, my goodness, when you see a pack of GT cars, and actually hear a pack of GT cars, because in this category you have V8s, you have turbocharged V8s, you have V10s, you have V6 turbocharged cars, and it's just quite something. It's just to close your eyes when the pack goes past is a great experience.
And there's also the diversity of shapes and sounds. I mean, the science of the wind tunnel has long since dictated the shape of a Formula One car, and whatever people have come up with the new rules, in 6 or 8 months' time, they'll all look pretty much the same. GTs don't. And that's one of the things I really like about it.
Especially the Bentley and the Aston Martins, which seem quite sort of blunt. Yeah. And then you kind of see the sort of Ferrari equivalent. It's like, wow, they're in the same class even. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I have to say, one of the things when I'm at Alton Park, which is quite a lot.
You've been to Alton Park?
Once or twice, yeah.
Really? Okay. You should tell us.
You're standing taking photographs at Hilltop as the cars come out of Lodge Corner and then onto the pit straight. You can actually stand with your elbow more or less on top of the Armco as they come with a wide-angle lens as they come past. And when the Bentley GT3 comes past you, I mean, the wake, I mean, it more or less knocks you to Manchester. It's a lovely thing. I mean, you get used to it after a while. It's great.
Yeah, I love the way the cars express their personality and the way they look and they sound, and yet they can be competitive. I know there are a number of faults with balance of performance, but if you had to dream up a way a Bentley racing car behaves, it's exactly how you just described. And if you had to come up with a way of how a Ferrari racing car behaves, it's the scream of and the sparks of a 488. So it's...
Just going to add, really, that Dickie's, I mean, I know he's obviously a very accomplished driver and he's driven an awful lot, but what I love about him and what this piece really shows is that he can't quite get rid of the childish or childhood kind of thrill of driving all these cars. So when you read his piece, he kind of talks about it almost in like a dream sequence, and he wakes up at the end and the spell is broken as he gets out of the car. And it's that sort of just absolute love of what he does. And he hasn't lost that, even though he's driven everything and he could be kind of hardened to it. And he's not, he's just still so enthusiastic. And that really comes across in this piece particularly, I think.
Yeah, I think we'd all hate him if he wasn't such a lovely guy, wouldn't we?
Right, well, before we talk about the Ross Brawn interview, exciting news. For those that remember 1960s in Focus and 1970s in Focus, there's another one coming, and this one is called Le Mans in Focus. No prizes for guessing what it's about, but expect what came before, some absolutely beautiful unseen images, and it's sort of packed full of beauty, isn't it, Damon, of In Focus series?
It is. I've just got to get the 400-odd pictures down to about 100 or so to fit in. Then we'll be okay. But they are all amazing. So, it's a great product. I love putting it together. It's a real labour of love. So I can't wait for it to be finished.
Yeah. Well, you can actually pre-order. Sorry, Simon. You can pre-order it at the website, which is motorsportmagazine.com, and that's /shop. You can pre-order, and it will be available very soon. Sorry, Simon.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm really looking forward to capturing the bloody things as well. take a couple of days.
We really do love doing it here. It's one of our favourite jobs. So the Ross Brawn interview. It's Mark Hughes has sat down with Ross Brawn, who's now in sort of a key position in the big sort of in Formula One. Nick, this was sort of one of the very first big interviews he did, isn't it? And he chose to do it with us.
Yeah. Of course, when the news broke, or actually even when the rumours started to circulate that Ross was going to take a role in the management and indeed the direction of Formula One. Yeah, it was a case of we need to talk to him as soon as possible. But of course, everybody else in the world wanted to do that. Mark, being Mark and having a great relationship with a lot of the key figures in the sport, managed to talk to Ross pretty much directly and arrange a time to sit down and talk. And I'm pretty sure we got it first, didn't we? I mean, our schedule.
Yeah,
we may have published second, but yeah. They're just details.
Mere details. Sure we got it. Yeah, we got him at. We spoke to him at Barcelona, in Barcelona during testing, and had a one-on-one sit down with him, which was great.
Do we? What does everyone think? Is it the right man for the job?
100%.
Yeah, I'd concur completely. I mean, he's just his wealth of experience in all domains. I mean, you know, running a business, running a team. Everything, his understanding of the sport, sports cars and Formula One, just vast.
But it's worth noting that not a lot is going to change in the next few years, is it? I mean, really the big change he's looking for is 2020.
Everything is so entrenched the way it is at the moment. It'll be like Brexit. I mean, trying to untangle everything, everyone says 2 years, it'll probably take 10. I mean, this could take a time, because you've got to recondition people's thinking, and that will take time.
Yeah, and we do get a bit of an insight into the way Ross Brawn is thinking about the future of Formula One in this piece.
Yeah, he's very clever in the way that he presents his information, and he's teased a few elements that, in the way that he teased the Race of Champions concept earlier on in the year, he's teased a few things that are clearly there for us all to think about. You know, the first thing for me is watching Australia. How we desperately needed another 2 to 4 cars on that grid, no matter the quality of racing or anything else. It just looked too sparse to be the foremost most motor racing event in the world. So he's certainly got the biggest job, but there's no bigger brain, I think, to solve a myriad of problems with F1.
Well, he certainly talks about spending caps in this piece, and he's the key thing I think that he's talking about as well is that he is thinking things through. So he's not just coming to knee-jerk reactions or sort of off-the-wall ideas about what might work, and they end up not working, as we may have seen, you know, with the rule changes this season. But he's thinking really deeply about how things can work in the long term and planning it. And that's very much his style, and I think that'll come out. We'll see that playing out over the next few years.
Yeah. Exciting times.
One snippet as well that he hints at is that he, when he took the job, he doesn't say so in as many words, but it's pretty clear reading between the lines that he said it was either him or Bernie, which was the reason that. That Bernie has sort of
sped up the exit,
moved upstairs when it came to Liberty asking Ross to take the job.
Fast forwarding on to page 108, and we've got a piece here called Land of the Rising Suns. And Darren Cox has actually written this, and it's on Japan's Super Formula, which used to provide plenty of Formula One drives, but sort of went through a little bit of a dip. It seems to have changed. Certainly, Stoffel Van Dorn is a big name that's been there recently. Simon, knowing you, you've probably been to all of these races.
All the two. Park, yeah, Super Formula doesn't do Alton Park or Mallory, I'm afraid.
It's not worth going to.
But I have.
Give it time, Simon.
during my privileged time as a Formula One correspondent, I did go to Suzuka many times. And in the last couple of years, Super Formula did support the Japanese Grand Prix, so I have seen the cars. And they are impressive. They are quick. I mean, because of the tyres, they're probably a little bit quicker than GP2. I mean, there was a time 20-odd years ago when Japanese Formula 3000, as it was called then, I mean, the qualifying tyres they had were so soft that I think Hans-Harald Frentzen once qualified on pole at a time that would put him 6th or 7th on the Japanese Grand Prix grid. I mean, they couldn't race at that pace. But that's always been part of the Japanese culture, the tyre technology. And Formula Nippon was very strong for a while, went through a dip, and as you say, it's now coming back. McLaren plays Stoffel Van Dorn in Super Formula to keep himself race fit while they're waiting for an F1 seat to arise. And this year, Red Bull has done exactly the same with Pierre Gasly, GP2 champion last year, who will be up against some very stiff opposition, Andre Lotterer, guys like that, in Super Formula this year. And it is on the rise again, and it gets good crowds.
Yeah, and it's the return of Darren Cox as well as a writer.
Yeah, so Darren, you know, with his involvement with Nismo, spent a lot of time in Japan, knows the Japanese working culture, the positives and the negatives of it. And he worked closely with Jan Mardenborough on the GT Academy Gamer to Racer. And of course, Jan is racing in Super Formula this year. And Jan's a star. You know, this is a guy who was plucked from his bedroom in Cardiff, and he's delivered in every single car. His stellar performances at Le Mans. And
he was second in the Japanese F3 Championship last year, which is no mean feat.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's interesting that we've got this. We talked about it the other day, actually, in the office about, you know, the fact that Max Verstappen is kind of bringing the average age of Formula One drivers down, and then drivers that are over 22 are considered, you know, old farts and are past it, you know. And yeah, you've got guys like Jan who are qualified for Formula One and Dean Stoneman and some of these like absolutely scintillating drivers that are almost considered over the hill. But I'm hoping, you know, because Jan's such a fantastic driver, great story, that, you know, this could really propel him, you know, into F1, where I personally believe he belongs, you know, with Gasly.
Now, before we come on to lunch with, I'm going to come to you, Simon, on that one.
Because I like lunches.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and you had lunch with this person.
Yeah,
probably more of the latter than the former. So I must tell you all about the Hall of Fame auction preview drinks. H&H Classics Woodcote Park auction is taking place at the Royal Automobile Club the day before the Hall of Fame event. On June the 5th, we're going to host a special auction preview evening, which will give you the chance to look at all the lots while enjoying the club's grounds at Woodcote Park. You can buy tickets for this and the preview drinks, and it only costs £17. Money well spent, I would say. Again, just go to the website, motorsportmagazine.com/Hall of Fame. Okay, lunch with Malcolm Wilson. Simon, how were your West Coast scallops, lamb, what else, sticky toffee pudding, all washed down with pouille fissé?
No, that's Malcolm's.
Malcolm. I guarantee you didn't have a salad.
I went for the veggie option. The photographer's job is to order the same meal as the guest, and he was very relieved that Malcolm was the guest and he wasn't, because the photographer takes pictures of the meal.
I've always wondered that. So yeah. You don't stop the guest eating.
No.
So
what, we're paying for two lunches?
Well, three. Three, no. Claude, yeah. Three if you
include Simon's, yeah. Well, that's it. That's the end of lunch, really, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Throwing money at it all. That is, sorry, so David, just to, you ordered two sets of the guest's lunch.
Yeah, so the photographer will sit just off to one side from where the guys are actually having their conversation. Order the same.
This is breaking news.
It is. My goodness.
Brexit and Trump.
Not read the expectation.
I am now.
I have always wondered how awkward it must be when the guest got his food, but then the doctor said, no, hang on. With a fork halfway to his mouth. Anyway, Simon, tell us about the lunch with and the three lunches.
I did go, as I say, for the veggie option, but. Malcolm was fascinating. It was an absolutely lovely setting, northern edge of Ullswater. It was a beautiful day. I arrived 2 hours early. Slightly poignant for me because my mum had passed away the previous day, and I arrived early and just went for a walk in the hills to gather my thoughts. and then met Malcolm for lunch. And it was a lovely sunny day when I arrived. But being the Lake District, by the time Malcolm arrived, it was a force-8 gale. Ullswater was more or less hitting the hotel windows because the wash was so vicious. But we sat down and if I hadn't had to drive back to Kent that day, I might still be sitting there chatting, because Malcolm is a fascinating guy. I mean, a Ford man through and through, but he's building his own escorts and stuff from the age of 10 or 11, tinkering in his parents' scrapyard. And, you know, 50 years on, he's running the Ford World Rally Championship team, having driven Fords for the best part of 20 years, and he's now run the WRC team for 20 years. Fond of what I found to be very interesting stories, and just a lovely, affable guy. And the fact that he always set out to create a successful motorsport business in Cumbria, which isn't quite next to Silverstone and Banbury and where everyone else is, and has made it work. And if you do a good enough job, people will come and find you. And despite Cumbria being where it is, and it is a fantastic part of the world, I love it, he's made it work, and he's now got 260-odd people working for him at twin factories in Cumbria, and also a secondary factory in Poland. For a kid who left school at 15 with no qualifications, it's quite a story.
Yeah. There's hope for all of us yet, then.
he's just getting better as well. He just signed OJ, hasn't he? So.
And he's of course the Bentley.
And the Bentleys, yeah.
And he's running the Bentleys. Yeah.
And the World Rallycross team.
And he's also providing cars for World Rallycross. Bentley, he didn't pitch for that because they've got no racing experience. Bentley approached him, and he initially said, well, we don't do racing. But Bentley insisted, and, story you'll see read in the next issue of Motorsport about the Bentley GT3 program that Andrew Frankel's written. That's all being run by N-Sport.
He talks quite fondly about Colin McRae as well, doesn't he?
He does. I'm not going to give away everything he says, he does come up with some very interesting and surprising insight about McRae's driving technique.
Is it as surprising as the fact that three lunches are ordered for two
That's
people?
That's a real revelation here, isn't it?
I'd say that
has literally blown my mind.
Well, Damon was fully aware
of it. How fat is the photographer?
And why don't we bring a doggy bag? At least.
I'm not sure the sticky toffee pudding would travel somewhere.
It's quite a hike from Ullswater down to London, though, so it would have been cold.
Yeah.
Very cold.
Right, well, we are nearing the end, so I just wanted to quickly talk about Gordon Cruickshank's visit to Blakeney Motors Sport, this race preparation company that from the photos, you can see E-types, Cobras, Mustangs, Bugattis, they're all being prepped. There's been a sort of a meteoric rise in historic racing and the popularity of it, and so these companies have sort of been given a new lease of life, haven't they, Damon? There's loads of lovely images in here.
Well, the great thing about this particular story is that this is going on up and down the country, all over England. These amazing little
Great Britain.
Sorry,
not independent yet, are we?
Okay. is that kind of day, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's plenty of these all over the place where they are preparing cars, not just for Goodwood, which this particular feature was focusing on, but for many, many events and historic events all around the world now. I mean, the historic world is global. I mean, the cars that are prepared here go off all around the world. And this particular sort of garage that we went to, or preparation place we went to, prepared, I think, 8 or 9 cars for the Goodwood members meeting alone. So they certainly have the work cut out. So we sent a photographer down to sort of capture the sort of busyness and how they were going to get all these cars ready for one event.
So the final piece in the sort of feature jigsaw for this month's motorsport is... The second last piece,
yeah.
Nick.
Sorry, I'm going to jump in because I'm going to say that when you pick up your copy, don't forget, if you're in the States, you can pick up your copy in Barnes & Noble and any other independents. I need to get that one in. page 129, if you look at the image that's on the top right and you look behind the car... That is centre. Is that a Bugatti?
It is.
Okay. Well, I won't give away what the car is behind, but just spend some time when you have a look at this piece, just scouring and looking over the images, because the car that's in the foreground is not always as exciting as the car that's in the background. And that's the kind of joy of these workshops, isn't it? Your eye falls, there's something. And as I say, the top of page 129, top right, the car in the background, it's orange and it's...
It's very cool.
It's glorious.
Very cool. Right. The, sorry, no, not at all. Not at all. Damon, I'm going to come to you for this one. Obviously, we have you were there, which is, you know, usually a page or two. And then we sometimes, when the images are really good, we do private view, which might stretch to sort of 2-3 pages. But this private view is massive.
Yeah.
What's the story behind these photos?
Well, a chap called Dick Lees actually sent photos in even before I started. It was that long ago. And he was a photographer around in the 60s and 70s that was an enthusiastic amateur and sadly passed away recently. But his pictures, as it says here, serve as a tribute to him. But the lovely thing about this was obviously in those days you could just stroll around, take pictures wherever you were. There was no restrictions. You could go on a walk around and take your camera into the pits and the paddock, and no one would stop you. But the lovely thing about these ones is that we have. This is just a small, tiny proportion of what Dick was sort of that he sent in. He had literally hundreds of them, so it was a challenge to get them down to God 6 or 7 pages of however many it was. And obviously, I think our favourite one is
don't tell them what it is.
One of Beat and Beat.
But it's what page is it, Damon?
It is on page 138.
Okay, and it's two characters in conversation leant against a lorry. One who doesn't have. Well, I'm not going to say anymore.
No, that's it.
On that marketing, it's a beautiful example.
You're going to have to buy it.
And which you can do at motorsportmagazine.com/shop. You can buy the latest issue there, but I highly recommend subscribing. Much less hassle, and you get it much earlier than everyone else. Damon, thank you so much for your words of wisdom. Nick, thank you. Joe, thank you. And Simon, thank you very much. We'll return next month for the June preview. We'll see you all then. Thanks so much for listening.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.